Standard Time and Monday night. In Australia today, in New Guinea, nature has beaten the Japanese attempts to make new airfields in the Markham Valley. Sudden floods have forced the Japanese to withdraw a considerable distance towards their main bases at Leh and Salamaua. Rainfalls of up to 40 inches have changed tributaries of the Markham River into powerful torrents. Floodwaters have swept over the alluvial flats which make up most of the valley, and the area is no longer tenable. F.D. Fulton, who reports this in a dispatch to the Melbourne Herald, says that the Japanese occupation of the north coast of New Guinea has proved a costly failure. Ships, planes, and men have been lost without any commensurate advantage. Now that rain has spoiled Japanese plans for using the Markham Valley, he says, the enemy will have his forces concentrated at Leh and Salamaua, but will be able to do very little with them for some time. Allied fighters and ground defenses destroyed four Japanese planes for certain and probably shot down four others in air warfare over Darwin and Port Moresby in the weekend. This is stated in communiques released in Australia today. Two Allied planes were lost. Experienced Australian pilots from the Middle East are now serving with the Australian Air Force in New Guinea. Some of the men are from the Middle East squadron, which has shot down nearly 200 enemy planes. These pilots have already scored several successes against fighters and bombers in the New Guinea area. The Australian Broadcasting Commission's war correspondent says that the latest types of American aircraft have been given to Australian pilots in New Guinea. Some of these machines took part in the raid on Leh, during which 20 Japanese aircraft were destroyed a short time ago. The Melbourne Herald correspondent in Papua estimates that the Japanese lost more than 50 planes in the New Guinea area this week. The Japanese, he says, are having trouble in keeping their planes in fighting trim in the New Guinea climate. A Zero fighter shot down recently had its cylinders so heavily coated with carbon that the machine could not possibly put up a first-class performance. Prime Minister Curtin revealed today that 240 people were killed in the first Japanese air raid on Darwin on February 19th. He said that he had received a report by Mr. Justice Lowe, who was detailed some time ago to investigate all aspects of the attack. After the raid, only the casualties in the town itself were announced, and these numbered 15. Casualties on Darwin Harbour were kept secret because it was considered that they would be of value to the enemy. Mr. Curtin said that the number of casualties might be reduced when some more waterside workers communicated with the authorities. The damage to Darwin Town was small, said Mr. Curtin, and there was no reason to suspect espionage. Momentous inter-allied staff talks began at American Army headquarters in Australia at the weekend and continued today. General Douglas MacArthur, Supreme Commander in the Southwest Pacific, met General Sir Thomas Blamey, Commander-in-Chief of Allied Land Forces, for the first time when the talks opened. High-ranking United States and Australian Army officers took part in the conference. The broad principles of Allied strategy for the defense of Australia against Japanese aggression are believed to have been discussed. As a result of these talks and recent conferences between General MacArthur and Federal Minister, many changes in the command and organization of the Australian Army will probably be announced. General Blamey said yesterday that in any changes in Army organization, great emphasis would be placed on Army air cooperation. He said that units of the Australian Imperial Forces that had returned to Australia from the Middle East would not be split up for service in Australia. But it is expected that experienced officers and men of the Australian Imperial Force will be sprinkled throughout the Home Defence Army in order to instruct the less experienced men. Commando units will form a part of the Allied Land Forces here. The presence of a small number of coloured American troops in Australia has been announced. These men, it is stated, are skilled specialist ground troops who have proved themselves invaluable members of the American Army. Most of the colored soldiers are from southern states. Australians remember that colored American troops had a fine record with the American Expeditionary Force in World War I. The Melbourne Herald predicts tonight that a senior Australian Army officer will be sent to Washington shortly to represent Australia on the Allied Chiefs of Staff Committee to be initiated soon. The paper says that Lieutenant General George Brett, who will command the Allied Air Force, will be in charge of Royal Australian Air Force Squadron. General Brett, the paper adds, will be Deputy Commander-in-Chief of all Allied forces in the Southwest Pacific, but General Blamey will act directly through General MacArthur in all matters relating to Allied land forces. President Quezon of the Philippines has joined General MacArthur at American headquarters in Australia. President Quezon and his cabinet traveled in a special two-car railway train to a point near the American headquarters. They were welcomed at the station by General MacArthur and other American officers and driven to headquarters by car. The arrival was secret and there was no public reception. President Quezon wore a leather jacket and a battered felt hat. He greeted General MacArthur warmly. Colonel Diller, United States Public Relations Officer, declared yesterday that President Quezon's arrival in Australia would result in an uplift in morale in Japanese-occupied areas of the Philippines. He said, quote, "The arrival of President Quezon in Australia will enable him to have valuable outside contact and to conduct more efficiently the administration of his government. General MacArthur and President Quezon have worked together for years, and they understand each other perfectly," unquote. United States headquarters said that President Quezon had arrived in good health and spirit, but looked a little worn. He had made a remarkable recovery from a serious illness which he suffered about 12 months ago. As an additional security measure, more Italians in the state of Queensland have been rounded up by police and military officers and sent to internment camps. No numbers have been announced, but it was stated in Brisbane that the roundup was on a large scale. Most of the Italians were taken from the Cairn, Innisfail, and Atherton Tableland district. Cairns is a port on North Queensland coast about 1,000 miles from Brisbane and one of the nearest important centres in Australia to Japanese-occupied New Guinea. Stories both sad and gay are told in hundreds by Australian force men who have returned to Australia after service in many campaigns in the Middle East. On the whole, the men prefer to talk of the finer side. One pilot laughed at the recollection of his escape from a German fighter plane who tried to machine gun him. He sought refuge behind a tree, but the plane followed him round. He ran round to the other side of the tree, and again the plane followed him round. So he kept running, and the plane kept following, and the game of hide-and-seek went on for some time, but the pilot won. The German gave up in disgust and flew away, leaving his intended victim alive and laughing. That ends today's news review from Australia, read by John Royal. Americans have long had a deep and lively sympathy for India in her march toward independence. We in Australia know that, for we share that sympathy. We enjoy dominion status, and we know what a desirable thing the right of self-government is. We have not at any time been blind admirers of every facet of British government in India. We believe that the British themselves would be prepared to admit that they have not always achieved perfection in this department. They would admit, firstly, we know, that Britain's original interest in India was economic, and that the political side of India's organization has been largely influenced by British economic interests there. There has been an amount of economic selfishness, and most Englishmen would today be ready to admit that in the dealings of some British trainers and British officers with the Indians, there has existed an aura of Western superiority which is completely out of place with today's thought and events. In addition, it may be admitted that the particular offer now made to India, guaranteeing her dominion status immediately after the war, might not have been made so soon if there had not existed a desperate need to hold India for the United Nations. Those are facts which we face quite frankly and quite honestly. But perhaps we, in our sympathy with Indian aspirations, have been a little too uncritical or credulous in accepting all the claims that have been put forward on India's behalf. While we have the best will possible towards India, there have in the past been real obstacles in the way of granting full independence. Most of these were due to the many divisions among her people. Sir Stafford Cripps, the British emissary to India, emphasized today that Britain Britain could not possibly declare her offer of Dominion status unless the people of India themselves were in substantial agreement in desiring it. We're inclined to think of India as one country, forgetting the tremendous divisions between her different creeds, between her different nations, in the multiplicity of languages, and in her divergent political systems. We forget the divisions between the native states and the British states. Indeed, it's extremely doubtful that India would have gained much if Britain had granted her independence years ago. Chaos might well have followed, and a divided and relatively helpless India could have become the prey of the nation whose ambitions are already leading her over the hills of Burma. In reply to this, the Indians have said, well, perhaps we would have been in a mess, but it would have been a mess of our own creating. It would not have been a condition created by outsiders. Yes, that's all very well. But today, India's external relations are of extreme importance to all the United Nations. China's capacity to continue the war may well depend on her collaboration with India. The Middle East, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, all depend on support from India. Allied control of the Indian Ocean depends on our holding Indian ports and bases, particularly Trincomalee. The Axis strategy provides that Berlin and Tokyo should join hands in India, and these are things which declare today India's vital importance in the battle for world freedom. And it's a battle for India's freedom as much as for the freedom of any other single nation. British rule in India may not have achieved 100% perfection, but it was certainly a more benevolent and a more progressive rule than India could have expected had she been left defenseless before Aryan Germany or the heaven-descended Japanese. For one, she could have become another Czechoslovakia, and for the other, she could have become another Manchukuo. British control and British protection have undoubtedly saved India from this, and that control has, during the years, certainly become more enlightened and more flexible. It may not have been startlingly progressive, but neither has it been darkly retrogressive. Whatever else British rule may have meant to India, it has at least meant a cloak and a shield. What time India herself resolved her internal perplexities and found the path that led to nationhood. Today, we, like you, view India's position and aspirations with complete sympathy. But we know that Britain cannot, Britain dare not, go beyond the offer she makes now. That offer must be conditioned by the necessity for holding India for the United Nations until the Axis is finally crushed and the work of reconstruction begins. In that work of reconstruction, India will not be forgotten. The Indians are logical people. They have the gift of seeing clearly. Surely they must see that now is not the time to launch upon the stormy sea of independence across whose many beams are imperfectly joined. It is better to await the days of complete and guaranteed tranquility before experimenting with the lives and happiness of so many millions of people. This is Australia. Jeffrey Sayer is beginning today a series of three talks to American listeners in which he's going to tell you something about how Australia is getting down to the matter of organizing for war. He has called his talks, Australia Gets Down to It. And he's here now to give the first of them, Jeffrey Sawyer.
You must often have heard it said, Australians are a casual, indisciplined people, but we refuse to take orders and won't cooperate. We're always having strikes, lockouts, political squabs. I rather suspect that you Americans have something of the same kind of reputation. So it may be of some interest to tell you about some of the ways in which our government is now turning ploughshares into swords. The fact is that the lives of the Australian people are being revolutionised by government control. Of course, we started this long before the Japanese came into the war. But since then, there's been a tremendous extension of government planning in every side of our daily lives. The picture I give you must be incomplete, since every day sees some civilian activity restricted or prohibited, and the war machine correspondingly strengthened. We wake up each morning and wonder, am I still reserved? Or is my factory still essential? Or only semi-essential? Or has it become non-essential? as to whether we are strong reserves does not refer to the phlegmatic calm of mind of the Anglo-Saxon, but to our occupation. If that ceases to be in the schedule of reserved occupations, then we have to find ourselves in khaki within a week or so. The regulations and orders giving effect to these changes are terse in the extreme, but they come out at such a rate that they fill dry, fat, and well-indexed volumes. Let's see some practical results. Petrol rationing was introduced into this country towards the end of 1940. We've no wells of our own, and already by that time, tanker space was becoming short, and the demands of the armed forces greater and greater. The ration had already reached bedrock before December of last year. In fact, we got onto this more promptly than the British, though till recently we were not in the firing line. About 60,000 motor vehicles, as a result, have gone out of civilian use. The best of these, of course, have been diverted to war purposes. The average private ration is now 4 gallons per month, enough to do about 80 miles per month, with correspondingly less for baby cars and more for essential services. We're trying to maintain this ration so that a considerable number of private cars are kept in running order and with their tanks full to meet such emergencies as the evacuation of women and children. Many thousands of cars have been fitted with gas-producing units, a gadget you might be familiar with. It's an device for supplying the ordinary car engine with carbon monoxide gas derived from charcoal. So the result is not so powerful, but a good deal smaller than petrol combustion. The production of these charcoal units is itself strictly controlled, and only such people as doctors can now obtain them. People who may obtain them are gently coerced into doing so by having their petrol rations drastically curtailed. This sounds simple, but it has necessitated a prodigious job in planning and organisation. And of course, it's introduced problems and so on. Petrol speakeasy, the ration ticket forger, have to be hunted down, and the claims for special consideration of thousands of indignant citizens have to be examined. Fortunately, my back of this job was broken before the Pacific War started. The diversion of peace energy into war energy has been tackled by several methods. Taxation is one method of persuading John Citizen to forego a new suit for his wife, a fur coat. And about 30% of the national income now goes to the government in this way. Loans to the government do the same thing. War saving certificates, costing about $6 each, are continually on sale, and many millions of civilian purchasing power have been diverted through them and through the periodical large-scale loans, such as the $100 million loan, which has just been oversubscribed. These methods, however, are not nearly sufficient. For one thing, a good deal of this purchasing power dribbles back into civilian channels, through the munitions workers and allowances to the families of fighting men. In the last resort, rationing is the fairest and quickest method, and it is in fact being achieved indirectly, though only petrol is as yet officially rationed. Tobacco, for instance, is being unofficially rationed by the retail distributors. Large quantities of such tobacco as is available are requisitioned from the wholesalers by the armed forces, whose smoking requirements by general agreement are placed first. The result is that my tobacconist doles me out an ounce of ready rub per week. Tea has become very scarce since the fall of the NEI, with the result that my grocer lets me have £1 per week. This sort of voluntary rationing, carried out spontaneously by the tradesmen concerned, saves the government departments a lot of precious time. Fortunately, the essentials of civilian life in fur and clothes are so plentiful that no question of rationing arises. What does arise is the problem of non-essential and semi-essential supplies and services. It's here that the government comes in. We have never had in this country what you Americans have had, the absurdity that duplicated rail, tramway, gas, electric, and such like services, with the consequent waste of skilled labour, material, and perpetual tearing up of road services. But we have had till recently, as you still have, a kind of duplication which the average person takes for granted, and which is an almost criminal luxury in wartime. That is, duplication of milk, bread, meat, and other such deliveries. The rattling up and down the street of six different milkmen in the early morning seemed to most of us part of a natural order. It depended, of course, on the old classical argument of competition. A single milkman could not be trusted to give proper service. In wartime, however, there are other motives for service besides competition, and the Australian people are developing a lively sense of such motives. Hence we've introduced, and are still introducing, rationalisation in all these spheres. Milk zoning is almost completed. Bread zoning is on the way. Retail stores have for some time had a voluntary system of cooperative transport for such parcels, and they have to be pretty heavy, as customers cannot carry with them. In Sydney, not only the distribution, but also the production of pastry cook products has been zoned. These measures have not been introduced by Hitlerian methods. The outline schemes, with the necessary allocation of areas and customers, has been prepared by the employers' associations and trade unions in the relevant industries, and been marked into final shape by the state control boards, or by the Department of War Organization of Industry. In this way, large numbers of men, women, and vehicles have been released for the army or for war production, and great savings made in the consumption of petrol. In the case of Sydney, the pastry cooks is typical. Some hundreds of cooks were released. Many went into the army. Some went to the shearing sheds, which were desperately short of cooks. Nearly 200 motor vans were rendered idle. These were not suitable for immediate war use, so the Pastry Cooks Union has taken them over, and with the assistance of Sydney Technical College, is turning them into mobile kitchens for emergency use amongst the civilian population in case of air raids. At the same time, members of this union still engaged in cafes and such like are undergoing, in their own time and at their own expense, courses in myths of cooking, so that they can man the mobile canteens in case of emergency. This is a typical example of the way in which masters and men are collaborating to tear down the old comfortable structure of peacetime life and to replace it by the spare taut lines of a war economy. In my next talk, I shall say something about our last effort of dealing with misdirected social energy, the prohibition of certain kinds of production.
That was Geoffrey Sawyer commencing a new series of talks entitled Australia Gets Down to It. And now, here are the announcements referred to earlier in this transmission. Our evening program for the Western States today will be heard at a different time. Our program will begin at 9:25 p.m. Pacific War Time. The news will be read at 9:30 p.m. Pacific War Time. And the transmitter will be VLG7, Melbourne, 15.16 megacycles per second in the 19 meter band. Commencing Tuesday, tomorrow morning, our morning program for the Western States will be heard from 8 to 8:45 a.m. Pacific Wartime from two stations VLQ6 Sydney, 9.58 megacycles, and VLD2 Melbourne, 9.54 megacycles per second. That's in the 31 meter band. Now here are the names of American soldiers who will broadcast in this transmission tomorrow, Tuesday, at approximately 7:45 a.m. American Eastern Wartime. Private F, First Class Private J.M. Murray, M-U-R-R-A-Y, 3, Francis Street, Gillespie, Illinois. Corporal Norman G. Hunter, H-U-N-T-E-R, Corporal Norman G. Hunter, 825 Gilman Avenue, Wichita, Kansas. 3, Private Frank C. Williams, W-I-L-L-I-A-M-S, Private Frank C. Williams. 622 Bidwell Street, St. Paul, Minnesota. Private W. G. Schroeder, S-C-H-R-O-E-D-E-R, Private W. G. Schroeder, 602 North Judge Street, Watertown, Wisconsin. Alex A. Krim, C-R-Y-N, Alex A. Krim, 732 Santa Gray Way, San Francisco, California. Sergeant Pat A. Birdwell, B-I-R-D-W-E-L-L, Sergeant Pat Birdwell. Route 1, Box 262, Las Cruces, New Mexico. Those men's voices will be heard in this program tomorrow morning, commencing at 7:45 American Eastern Time.